I'm going to skip the first few paragraphs, and which are just throat clearing, and begin in the middle of page 2. In this lecture, I'll take up the distinction between morality and prudence. This distinction is traditionally drawn by opposing unconditional and categorical obligations to conditional and hypothetical ones. Obviously, pragmatists are going to have doubts about the suggestion that anything is unconditional, for they doubt that anything is or could be non-relational. So they need to reinterpret the distinctions between morality and prudence, morality and expediency, and morality and self-interest in ways which dispense with the notion of unconditional obligation. Dewey suggested that we reconstruct the distinction between prudence and morality in terms of the distinction between routine and non-routine social relationships. He saw prudence as a member of the same family of concepts as habit and custom. All three words describe familiar and relatively uncontroversial ways in which individuals and groups adjust to the stresses and strains of their non-human and human environments. It's obviously prudent both to keep an eye out for poisonous snakes in the grass and to trust strangers less than members of one's family. Prudence, expediency, and efficiency are all terms which describe such routine, uncontroversial adjustments to circumstance. Morality and law, on the other hand, begin when controversy arises. We invent both when we can no longer just do what comes naturally, when routine is no longer good enough, when habit and custom no longer suffice. These will no longer suffice when the individual's needs begin to clash with those of her family, or her family's with those of her neighbors, or when economic strain begins to split her community into warring classes, or when that community must come to terms with an alien community. On Dewey's account, the prudence-morality distinction is, like that between custom and law, a distinction of degree, the degree of need for conscious deliberation and explicit formulation of precepts, rather than a distinction of kind. There's no distinction of kind for Dewey, for pragmatists like Dewey, between what's useful and what's right. For as Dewey said, quote, right is only an abstract name for the multitude of concrete demands in action which others impress upon us and of which we are obliged, if we would live, to take some account. The utilitarians were right when they coalesced the moral and the useful, but they were wrong insofar as they tried to reduce simply to getting pleasure and avoiding pain. Dewey agrees with Aristotle. He argues at great length against the utilitarians that human happiness cannot be reduced to the accumulation of pleasure. From Kant's point of view, however, Aristotle, Mill, and Dewey are equally blind to the true nature of morality. To identify moral obligation with the need to adjust one's behavior to the needs of other human beings is for Kantians either vicious or simple-minded. Dewey seems to Kantians to have confused duty with self-interest, the intrinsic authority of the moral law with the bonasic need to bargain with opponents whom one cannot overcome. Dewey was well aware of this Kantian sort of criticism. Here's one of the passages in which he attempted to answer it. Quote, morals, it is said, imply the subordination of fact to ideal consideration, while the view presented, Dewey's view, makes morals secondary to bare fact, which is equal to depriving them of dignity and jurisdiction. The criticism rests upon a false separation. It argues, in effect, that either ideal standards antecede customs and confer their moral quality upon them, or that, in being subsequent to customs and evolved from them, they are mere accidental byproducts. But how does it stand with language? Language grew out of unintelligent babblings, instinctive motions called gestures, and the pressure of circumstance, but nevertheless, language, once called into existence, is language and operates as language. The point of Dewey's analogy between language and morality is that there was no decisive moment at which language stopped being a series of reactions to the behavior of other humans and started to represent reality. Similarly, there was no point at which practical reasoning stopped being prudential and became specifically moral. No point at which it stopped being merely useful and started being genuinely authoritative. Dewey's reply to those who, like Kant, think of morality as stemming from a specifically human faculty called reason and of prudence as something shared with the brutes is that the only thing that's specifically human is language, but the history of language is a seamless story of gradually increasing complexity. The story of how we got from Neanderthal grunts and nudges to German philosophical treatises is no more discontinuous than the story of how we got from the amoebae to the anthropoids. The two stories are parts of one larger story. From an evolutionary point of view, there's no difference between the grunts and the treatises, save complexity. Yet the difference between the language-using and the mute animals, and the difference between cultures which don't engage in conscious collective moral deliberation and cultures which do, are as important and obvious as ever, even though they are differences of degree. On Dewey's view, philosophers who have sharply distinguished reason from experience or morality from prudence have tried to turn an important difference of degree into a difference of metaphysical kind. They have thereby constructed problems for themselves which are as insoluble as they are artificial. Dewey saw Kant in his moral philosophy as taking, quote, the doctrine that the essence of reason is complete universality and hence necessity and immutability, with the seriousness becoming the professor of logic. He interpreted Kant's attempt to get advice about what to do out of the mere idea of universalizability as offering not an impossible disregard of consequences, but merely a broad, impartial view of consequences. All that the categorical imperative does, Dewey said, is, quote, to commend the habit of asking how we should be willing to be treated in a similar case. The attempt to do more, to get, quote, ready-made rules available at a moment's notice for settling any kind of moral difficulty, quote, unquote, seemed to Dewey to have been born, quote, of timidity and nourished by love of authoritative prestige. Only such a tendency to sadomasochism, Dewey thought, could have, quote, led to the idea that absence of immutably fixed and universally applicable ready-made principles is equivalent to moral chaos. So much for the standard Deweyan criticism of the Kantian way of viewing the distinction between morality and prudence. I want now to turn to another distinction, that between reason and sentiment, thinking and feeling. Doing so will let me relate Dewey's work to that of the contemporary American moral philosopher, Annette Beyer. Beyer, one of the leading feminist philosophers in the U.S., takes David Hume as her model. She praises Hume as what she calls the woman's moral philosopher because of his willingness to take sentiment, and indeed sentimentality, as central to the moral consciousness. She also praises him for, quote, de-intellectualizing and de-sanctifying the moral endeavor, presenting it as the human equivalent of various social controls in animal or insect populations. Though Beyer rarely mentions Dewey, and Dewey rarely discusses Hume's moral philosophy at any length, these three militantly anti-Kantian philosophers are on the same side of most arguments. All three share the same distrust of the notion of moral obligation. Dewey, Beyer, and Hume might all agree with Nietzsche that the pre-Socratic Greeks were free from the timidity, the fear of having to make hard choices, which led Plato to search for immutable moral truth. All three see the temporal circumstances of human life as difficult enough without sadomasochistically adding immutable, unconditional obligations. Beyer has proposed that we substitute the notion of appropriate trust for that of obligation as our central moral concept. She has said, quote, there is no room for moral theory as something which is more philosophical and less committed than moral deliberation, and which is not simply an account of our customs and styles of justification, criticism, protest, revolt, conversion, and resolution, close quote. In words that echo some of Dewey's, Beyer says that, quote, the villain is the rationalist, law-fixated tradition in moral philosophy, a tradition which assumes that, quote, behind every moral intuition lies a universal rule. That tradition assumes that Hume's attempt to think of moral progress as a progress of sentiments fails to account for moral obligation. But on Beyer's view, as on Dewey's, there's nothing to account for. Moral obligation doesn't have a nature or source different from tradition, habit, and custom. Morality is simply a new and controversial custom. The special obligation we feel when we use the term moral is simply the special need we feel to act in a relatively unfamiliar, untried way, a way which may have unpredictable and dangerous consequences. Our sense that prudence is unheroic and morality heroic is merely the recognition that testing out the relatively untried is more dangerous, more risky than doing what comes naturally. Beyer and Dewey agree that the central flaw in much traditional moral philosophy has been the myth of the self as non-relational, as capable of existing independently of any concern for others, as a cold psychopath needing to be constrained to take account of other people's needs. This is the picture of the self which philosophers since Plato have interpreted in terms of the division between reason and the passions, a division which Hume unfortunately perpetuated in his notorious inversion of Plato, his claim that reason is and should be the slave of the passions. Ever since Plato, the West has construed the reason-passion distinction as paralleling the distinction between the universal and the individual, as well as that between unselfish and selfish actions. The religious, Platonic, and Kantian traditions have thus saddled us with the distinction between the true self and the false self, the self which hears the call of conscience, and the self which is merely self-interested. The latter self is merely prudential and not yet moral. Beyer and Dewey both argue that the notion of the self as cold, self-interested, calculating psychopaths should be set aside. If we really were such selves, the question, why should I be moral, would be forever unanswerable. Only when we masochistically picture ourselves as such selves do we feel the need to punish ourselves by quailing before divine commands or before Kant's tribunal of pure practical reason. But if we follow the pragmatist's advice to see everything as constituted by its relations to everything else, it will be easy to detect the fallacy which Dewey described as, quote, transforming the truistic fact of acting as a self into the fiction of acting always for self. We shall commit this fallacy and continue to think of the self as a psychopath in need of restraint as long as we accept what Dewey called, quote, the belief in the fixity and simplicity of the self. Dewey associated this belief with, quote, the theologian's dogma of the unity and ready-made completeness of the soul, but he might equally well have associated it with the argument of Plato's Phaedo or with Kant's doctrine that the moral self is a non-empirical self. If we put such notions of unity and ready-made completeness to one side, we can say with Dewey that, quote, selfhood, except insofar as it has encased itself in a shell of routine, is in process of making, and that any self is capable of including within itself a number of inconsistent selves, of unharmonized dispositions, close quotes. This notion of multiple inconsistent selves is, as Donald Davidson has shown us, a good way of naturalizing and demystifying the Freudian notion of the unconscious. But the most important link between Freud and Dewey is the one which Beyer emphasizes, the role of the family, and in particular of maternal love, in creating non-psychopaths, human selves who find concern for other human beings entirely natural. Beyer says, in words which Dewey might have written, that, quote, the secular equivalent of faith in God is faith in the human community and its evolving procedures in the prospects for many-handed cognitive ambitions and moral hopes, close quotes. But she sees that faith is rooted in the faith most of us have in our parents and siblings. The trust which holds a family together is Beyer's model for the secular faith which may hold together modern post-traditional societies. Freud helped us see that we get psychopaths, people whose self-conception involves no relations to others, only when parental love and the trust which such love creates in the child are absent. To see the point which Beyer wants us to appreciate, consider the question, do I have a moral obligation to my mother, to my wife, to my children? Morality and obligation seem inapposite terms. For doing what one is obliged to do contrasts with doing what comes naturally, and for most people, responding to the needs of family members is the most natural thing in the world. Such responses come naturally because most of us define ourselves, at least in part, by our relations to members of our family. Our needs and theirs largely overlap. We are not happy if they are not. We would not wish to be well fed while our children go hungry. That would be unnatural. Would it also be immoral? It's a bit strange to say so. One would only employ this term if one encountered a parent who was also a pathological egoist, a father or mother whose sense of self has nothing to do with her or his children, the sort of person envisaged by decision theory, someone whose identity is constituted by preference rankings rather than by fellow feeling. By contrast, I may feel a specifically moral obligation to deprive both my children and myself of a portion of the available food because there are starving people outside our door. The word moral is appropriate here because the demand is less natural than the demand that I feed my children. It's less closely connected with my sense of who I am. But the desire to feed the hungry stranger may, of course, become as tightly woven into my self-conception as the desire to feed my family. Moral development in the individual and moral progress in the human species as a whole is a matter of remaking human selves so as to enlarge the variety of the relationships which constitute those selves. The ideal limit of this process of enlargement is the self envisaged by Christian and Buddhist accounts of sainthood, an ideal self to whom the hunger or suffering of any human being, even perhaps that of any other animal, is intensely painful. Should this progress ever be completed, the term morality would drop out of the language, for there would no longer be any way nor any need to contrast doing what comes naturally with doing what is moral. We should all have what Kant called a holy will. The term moral obligation becomes increasingly less appropriate to the idea, to the degree to which we identify with those whom we help, the degree to which we mention them when telling ourselves stories about who we are, the degree to which their story is also our story. It comes fairly naturally to share what one has with an old friend or a near neighbor or a close business associate who has been left destitute by a sudden disaster. It comes less naturally to share with a casual acquaintance or a complete stranger who is in the same unfortunate situation. In a world in which hunger is common, it does not come naturally to take food from one's children's mouths in order to feed a hungry stranger and her children. But if the stranger and her children are on your doorstep, you may well feel obliged to do just that. The term moral and obligation become even more appropriate when it's a matter of depriving your children of something they want in order to send money to the victims of a famine in a country you've never seen, to people whom you might well find repellent if you ever encountered them, people whom you might not want as friends, might not want your children to marry, people whose only claim on your attention is that you have been told that they are hungry. But Christianity taught the West to look forward to a world in which there are no such people, a world in which all men and women are brothers and sisters. In that world, there would never be any occasion to speak of obligation. When moral philosophers in the Kantian tradition put sentiment on a par with prejudice and tell us that, from a strictly moral point of view, there is no difference between one's own hungry child and a randomly selected hungry child on the other side of the world, they're contrasting this so-called moral point of view with a point of view they call mere self-interest. The idea behind this way of speaking is that morality and obligation starts where self-interest stops. The problem with this way of speaking, Dewey insisted, is that the boundaries of the self are fuzzy and flexible. So philosophers in this tradition try to obscure this fuzziness by defining those boundaries. They do so by saying that the self is constituted by a preference ranking, one which divides people up according to whom one would prefer to be fed first, for example. Then they either contrast moral obligation with preference, or else subjectivize feelings of moral obligation by taking them as just further preferences. There are difficulties with both of these alternatives. If you contrast moral obligation with preference, you have trouble with the question of moral motivation. What sense does it make, after all, to say that a person acts against her own preferences? On the other hand, if you no longer distinguish between morality and self-interest and say that what we call morality is simply the self-interest of those who have been acculturated in a certain way, then you will be accused of emotivism, of having failed to appreciate Kant's distinction between dignity and value. One way leads to the question Plato tried to answer, why should I be moral? The other way leads to the question, is there any difference between a preference for feeding hungry strangers over letting them starve and a preference for vanilla over chocolate ice cream? More generally, one way seems to lead to a dualistic metaphysics, to splitting the universe, to splitting the human self and possibly the universe as a whole into higher and lower segments. The other seems to lead to a wholesale abnegation of our aspirations to something higher than mere animality. Pragmatists are often accused of just such an abnegation. They are lumped with reductionists, behaviorists, sensualists, nihilists, and other dubious characters. I think that the pragmatist's best defense against this sort of charge is to say that she too has a conception of our difference from the animals, but hers doesn't involve a sharp difference, a difference between the finite and the infinite of the sort illustrated by Kant's distinction between dignity and value, between the unconditioned and the conditioned, the non-relational and the relational. Rather, the pragmatist sees our difference as a much greater degree of flexibility, in particular, a much greater flexibility in the boundaries of selfhood, in the sheer quantity of relationships which can go to constitute a human self. She sees the ideal of human brotherhood and sisterhood not as the imposition of something non-empirical on the empirical, nor of something non-natural on the natural, but as the culmination of a process of adjustment, which is also a process of remaking the human species. From this point of view, moral progress is not a matter of an increase of rationality, a gradual diminution of the influence of prejudice and superstition, permitting us to see our moral duty more clearly. Nor is it what Dewey called an increase of intelligence, increasing skill at inventing courses of action which simultaneously satisfy many conflicting demands. People can be very intelligent in this sense without having wide sympathies. It's neither irrational or unintelligent to draw the limits of one's moral community at a national or racial or gender border. But it's undesirable, morally undesirable. So it's best to think of moral progress as a matter of increasing sensitivity, increasing responsiveness to the needs of a larger and larger variety of people and things. Just as the pragmatist sees scientific progress not as the gradual attenuation of a veil of appearance which hides the intrinsic nature of reality from us, but as the increasing ability to respond to the concerns of ever larger groups of people, especially the people who carry out ever more acute observations and perform ever more refined experiments, so they see moral progress as a matter of being able to respond to the needs of ever more inclusive groups of people. I want to pursue this analogy between science and morals a bit further. I said in earlier lectures that pragmatists don't think of scientific or any other inquiry as aimed at truth, but rather at better justificatory ability. Better ability to deal with doubts about what we're saying, either by shoring up what we previously said or by deciding to say something slightly different. The trouble with aiming at truth is that you wouldn't know it when you'd reached it, even if you did in fact reach it. But you can aim at assuaging ever more doubt. Analogously, you can't aim at doing what is right because you'll never know whether you've hit the mark. Long after you're dead, better informed and more sophisticated people may judge your action to have been a tragic mistake, just as they may judge your scientific beliefs to have presupposed an obsolete cosmology. But you can aim at ever more sensitivity to pain and ever greater satisfaction of ever more various needs. Pragmatists think the idea of something non-human luring us human beings on should be replaced with the idea of getting more and more human beings into our community, of taking the needs and interests and views of more and more diverse human beings into account. Justificatory ability is, on the pragmatist view, its own reward. There's no need to worry about whether we will be rewarded with a sort of immaterial medal labeled truth or moral goodness. The idea of a God's eye view to which science continually approximates is of a piece with the idea of the moral law to which social custom in periods of moral progress continually approximates. The ideas of discovering the intrinsic nature of physical reality and of clarifying our unconditional moral obligations are equally distasteful to pragmatists because both presuppose the existence of something non-rational, something exempt from the vicissitudes of time and history, something unaffected by changing human interests and needs. Both ideas are to be replaced, pragmatists think, by metaphors of width rather than of height or depth. Scientific progress is a matter of integrating more and more data into a coherent web of belief, data from microscopes and telescopes with data obtained by the naked eye, data forced into the open by experiment with data which always has been lying about. It's not a matter of penetrating appearance until one comes upon reality. and moral philosophy, moral progress is a matter of wider and wider sympathy rather than a matter of rising above the sentimental to the rational. Nor is it a matter of appealing from lower and corrupt local courts to a higher court which administers an ahistorical, non-local, transcultural moral law. The switch from metaphors of vertical distance to metaphors of horizontal extent ties in with the pragmatist's insistence on replacing traditional distinctions of kind with distinctions in degree of complexity. Pragmatists substitute the idea of a maximally efficient explanation of a maximally wide range of data for that of the theory which cuts reality at the joints. They substitute the idea of a maximally warm, sensitive, and sympathetic human being for the Kantian idea of a good will. But though maximality cannot be aimed at, you can aim at explaining more data or being concerned about more people. You can't aim at being at the end of inquiry in either physics or ethics. That would be like aiming at being at the end of biological evolution, at being not merely the latest heir of all the ages, but the being in which the ages were destined to culminate. Analogously, you can't aim at moral perfection, but you can aim at taking more people's needs into account than you did previously. So far in this lecture, I've been suggesting in rather general terms why the pragmatist would like to get rid of the notion of unconditional moral obligation. In the hope of greater concreteness and vividness, I turn now to another example of unconditionality, the notion of unconditional human rights. Such rights are said to form the fixed boundaries of political and moral deliberation. In American jurisprudence, as it's interpreted, for example, by Ronald Dworkin, rights trump every consideration of social expediency and efficiency. In much political discussion, it is taken for granted that the rights which the U.S. courts have interpreted the U.S. Constitution to bestow and the universal human rights enumerated in the Helsinki Declaration are beyond discussion. They are the unmoved movers of contemporary politics. From a pragmatist point of view, the notion of inalienable human rights is no better and no worse a slogan than that of obedience to the will of God. Either slogan, when invoked as an unmoved mover, is simply a way of saying that our spade is turned, that we have exhausted our argumentative resources. Talk of the will of God or the rights of man, like talk of the honor of the family or the fatherland in danger, are not suitable targets of philosophical analysis and criticism. It's fruitless to look behind them. None of these notions should be analyzed, for they're all ways of saying, here I stand, I can do no other. They are not reasons for action so much as announcements that one has thought the issue through and come to a decision. Traditional philosophy, the kind which sees morals as resting on metaphysics, presses such notions too hard when it asks questions like, but is there a God? Do human beings really have these rights? Such questions presuppose that moral progress is at least in part a matter of increasing moral knowledge, knowledge about something independent of our social practices, something like the will of God or the underlying nature of humanity. This metaphysical suggestion is vulnerable to Nietzschean suggestions that both God and human rights are superstitions, contrivances put forward by the weak to protect themselves against the strong. Whereas metaphysicians reply to Nietzsche by asserting that there is a rational basis for belief in God or in human rights, pragmatists replied that there is nothing wrong with contrivances. The pragmatist can cheerfully agree with Nietzsche that the idea of human brotherhood would only have occurred to the weak, to the people being shoved around by the brave, strong, happy warriors whom Nietzsche idolizes. But for pragmatists, this fact no more counts against the idea of human rights than Socrates' ugliness counted against his account of the nature of love, or than Freud's private little neuroses count against his account of love, or than Newton's theological and alchemical concerns count against his mechanics, or than Heidegger's bad moral character counts against his philosophical achievement. Once you drop the distinction between reason and passion, you will no longer discriminate against a good idea because of its dubious origins. You will classify ideas according to their relative utility rather than by their sources. Pragmatists think that the quarrel between rationalist metaphysicians and Nietzsche is without interest. They grant to Nietzsche that reference to human rights is merely a convenient way of summarizing certain aspects of our real or purported practices. Analogously, to say that the intrinsic nature of reality consists of atoms in the void is, for a pragmatist, a way of saying that our most successful scientific explanations interpret macrostructural change as a result of microstructural change. To say that God wills us to welcome the stranger within our gates is to say that hospitality is one of the virtues upon which our community prides itself. To say that respect for human rights demanded our intervention to save the Jews from the Nazis or the Bosnian Muslims from the Serbs is to say that a failure to intervene would make us uncomfortable with ourselves in the way in which knowledge that our children or our neighbors are hungry while we have plenty on the table makes us unable to continue eating. To speak of human rights is to explain our actions by identifying ourselves with a community of like-minded persons, those who find it natural to act in a certain way. Claims of the sort I've just made, claims which have the form to say such and such is to say so and so, are often interpreted in terms of the reality-appearance distinction. Metaphysically inclined thinkers, obsessed by the distinction between knowledge and opinion, or between reason and passion, interpret such claims as irrationalist and emotivist. But pragmatists don't intend these as claims about what's really going on, claims that what appeared to be a fact is actually a value, or what appeared to be a cognition is actually an emotion. Rather, these claims are practical recommendations about what to talk about, suggestions about the terms in which controversy on moral questions is best conducted. On the subject of atoms, the pragmatist thinks we should not debate the issue of whether unobservable microstructure is a reality or just a convenient fiction. On the subject of human rights, the pragmatist thinks that we should not debate whether human rights have been there all the time, even when nobody recognized them, or are just the social construction of a civilization influenced by Christian doctrines of the brotherhood of man and by the ideals of the French Revolution. In one sense of the term social construction, human rights are social constructions, but then so are neutrinos and giraffes. In that sense, to be a social construction is simply to be the intentional object of a certain set of sentences used in some societies and not in others. All that it takes to be an object is to be talked about in a reasonably coherent way, but not everybody needs to talk in all ways, nor therefore about all objects. Once we give up the idea that the point of discourse is to represent reality accurately, we shall have no interest in distinguishing social constructs from other things. We'll confine ourselves to debating the utility of alternative social constructs. The only other sense of social construction that I can think of is the one I referred to earlier, the sense in which bank accounts are social constructions but giraffes aren't. And here the criterion is simply causal. The causal factors which produced giraffes did not include human societies. Those which produced bank accounts did. This sense has no application to the question about human rights, for even the most fervent moral realist has no causal story to tell about how these rights came into being. To debate the utility of the set of social constructs we call human rights is to debate the question of whether the language games played by inclusivist societies are better than those played by exclusivist societies. There's no way to pass judgment on those language games without passing judgment on the societies as a whole, as wholes. So, instead of debating the ontological status of human rights, we should debate the question of whether communities which encourage tolerance of harmless deviance or treat deviance previously thought of as harmful as harmless, should be preferred to those communities whose social cohesion depends on conformity, on keeping outsiders at a distance, and on eliminating people who try to corrupt the youth. The best single mark of our progress toward a full-fledged human rights culture may be the extent to which we stop interfering with our children's marriage plans because of the national origin, the religion, the race, or the wealth of the intended partner, or because the marriage will be homosexual rather than heterosexual. Those who wish to supply rational philosophical foundations for a human rights culture say that what human beings have in common outweighs such adventitious factors as race and religion. But they have trouble spelling out what this commonality consists in. It's not enough to say that we all share a common susceptibility to pain, for there's nothing distinctively human about pain. If pain were all that mattered, it would be as important to protect the rabbits from the foxes as to protect the Jews from the Nazis. If one accepts a naturalistic Darwinian account of human origins, it's not helpful to say that we all have reason in common, for in this account to be rational is simply to be able to use language. But there are many languages, and most of them are exclusionist. The language of human rights is no more or less characteristic of our species than languages which insist on racial or religious purity. Pragmatists suggest that we simply give up the philosophical search for commonality. They think that moral progress might be accelerated if we focused instead on our ability to make the particular little things that divide us seem unimportant, not by comparing them with the one big thing that unites us, but by comparing them with other little things. We pragmatists think of moral progress as more like sewing together a very large, elaborate polychrome quilt than like getting a clearer vision of something true and deep. Here as elsewhere, we prefer metaphors of breadth and extent to metaphors of height and depth. Convinced that there's no subtle human essence which philosophy might grasp, we don't try to replace superficiality with depth, nor to rise above the particular to grasp the universal. Rather, we should like to minimize one difference at a time, the difference between Christians and Muslims in a particular village in Bosnia, the difference between blacks and whites in a particular town in Alabama, the difference between gays and straights in a particular Catholic congregation in Quebec. The hope is to sew such groups together with a thousand little stitches, to invoke a thousand little commonalities between their members rather than by specifying one great big commonality, their humanity. This picture of moral progress makes us resist Kant's suggestion that morality is a matter of reason and makes us sympathetic to Hume's suggestion that it's a matter of sentiment. If we were limited to these two candidates, we should side with Hume, but we would prefer to reject the choice and to set aside the old Greek faculty of psychology once and for all. We recommend dropping the distinction between two separately functioning sources of beliefs and desires, instead of working within the confines of this distinction, which constantly threatens us with the picture of a division between a true and real self and a false and apparent self, we can once again resort to the distinction with which I began my first lecture, the distinction between the present and the future. More specifically, we can see both intellectual and moral progress not as a matter of getting closer to the true or the good or the right, but as an increase in imaginative power. Imagination is the cutting edge of cultural evolution, the power which, given peace and prosperity, constantly operates so as to make the human future richer than the human past. Imagination is the source both of new scientific pictures of the physical universe and of new visions of possible communities. It's what Newton and Christ, Freud and Marx, had in common, the ability to re-describe the familiar in unfamiliar terms. Such redescription was practiced by the early Christians when they explained that the distinction between Jew and Greek was not as important as had been thought. It's being practiced by contemporary feminists whose descriptions of sexual behavior and marital arrangements seem as strange to many men, and for that matter many women, as St. Paul's indifference to traditional Judaic distinctions seemed to the scribes and the Pharisees. It is what the founding fathers of the United States attempted when they asked people to think of themselves not so much as Pennsylvania Quakers or Catholic Marylanders, but as citizens of a tolerant, pluralistic federal republic. It's being attempted by those passionate advocates of European unity who hope that their grandchildren will think of themselves as European first and French or German second. But an equally good example of such redescription is Democritus's and Lucretius's suggestion that we try thinking of the world as rebounding atoms, or Copernicus's suggestion that we try thinking of the sun as at rest. I said in an earlier lecture that pragmatism tries to substitute hope for knowledge. I hope that this lecture has helped make clear what I meant. The difference between the Greek conception of human nature and the post-Darwinian Deweyan conception is the difference between closure and openness, between the security of the unchanging and the Whitmanesque and Whiteheadian romance of throwing oneself into the process of unpredictable change. This apotheosis of the future, this willingness to substitute imagination for certainty and curiosity for pride, breaks down the Greek distinction between contemplation and action. Dewey saw that distinction as the great incubus from which intellectual life in the West needed to escape. His pragmatism was, as Hilary Putnam has said, an insistence on the supremacy of the agent point of view. In these lectures, I've been interpreting this supremacy as the priority of the hope of inventing new ways of being human over the need for stability, security, and order.